Okay, so give me a few testing, 1, 2, 3.
Okay, testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Okay, that sounds good to me. You can go ahead.
Okay, hello everybody. This is the second lecture in our course on Ayn Rand. Remember the last week I was at the Mises Institute for the Rothbard Graduate Seminar. We had quite a few problems with the Go All Right. Now, what I wanted to do today is to continue the discussion of Rand's metaphysics and epistemology. Remember last time I gave you an overview of the whole objectivist system, and then I said some things in a preliminary way about metaphysics and epistemology. Now, I do have to warn you, this is the toughest lecture in the course. If you can get through this, the rest should be pretty plain sailing. And the reason we have to get through metaphysics and epistemology, in addition to its important part of Rand's thought, is that she thought that this metaphysics and epistemology are really the foundational parts of philosophy. You couldn't understand the ethics and the political theory, which a lot of people are attracted to when they first read Rand. She thought to really understand the basis for the ethics and political theory, you really have to study the metaphysics and epistemology. And one thing we probably get into when we go into the ethics in the lecture next week is she right about that? Does the ethics, to what extent, if any, does her ethical system depend on her metaphysics and epistemology? But she certainly thought that it did. So that's one reason we're going to be covering that. As I say, I've tried to make this as simple as I can. People sometimes say I complicate things unnecessarily. Of course, people who say that are engaged in a vicious smear campaign against me. But I've tried to make it as easy as I can, but this is going to be probably the toughest one. So if you get through this, you don't have to worry about the other lectures. Now, what I first want to do is give a summary of some of the basic principles of objectivist metaphysics and epistemology theory of knowledge. Now, probably the most important principle of objectivism is what Rand calls the primacy of existence over consciousness. And what does she mean by that? Well, she divides philosophy. She looks at the history of philosophy and sees it as divided into two camps. There are philosophers who say, well, there's the world out there, the world that we're looking at. Say you're seeing me giving the lecture now, I'm seeing a computer screen in front of me, the world that's out there. And there's the philosophies that stress the mind. So the philosophy that stress the world out there say, well, what we're trying to do in philosophy is explain the nature of this world. And then other philosophies, she thinks, emphasize, say that the mind is primary. The mind really constructs reality. And she's very much against that. She thinks what philosophy has to do is respond to existence, has to respond to the world out there. Now, it certainly doesn't follow from her view that there's an external world out there that confronts us, that we don't make up out of our own mind, that the mind doesn't exist. On the contrary, she thinks, each of us knows that he or she is conscious. I know that I'm conscious. If I were to deny if I said I'm not conscious, I'd be denying reality. I'd be denying an aspect of existence. But consciousness is just part of existence. It's really not the main part of existence. It's what consciousness is conscious of the external world, and that's what's primary, what we're thinking of or seeing or perceiving, that's the external world, so that's primary. Consciousness is directed outward at the world. That means, well, but I can't just be saying I'm thinking. I have to think of something, or I have to, if I say I'm seeing, I can't just be seeing, I have to see something. Now, suppose, couldn't you say, well, don't I sometimes think about ideas that I have, maybe I have images, some people are very good, have a very vivid imagination, they can come up with pictures of all sorts of things in their mind. So somebody might say, well, look, the mind doesn't have to be directed outward at reality. Couldn't it be directed inward and could just think of things like images of things or just ideas I have in my own mind? Why does it have to be directed outward? So what Rand thought was that whenever I think of something that isn't an external object, then that's derived from perception of the external world. So if, say, let's say I close my eyes and picture, say, something, I can picture right now, I can picture Murray Rothbard talking to me. So I couldn't have that image unless I met the real Murray Rothbard. That's how I got my image of him. I couldn't just have an image that wasn't, at least in some sense, constructed out of things that I'd actually viewed, in her opinion. So its existence is primary over consciousness, but each person knows that he is conscious, and consciousness is directed outward. Now, to continue what we were just saying about all ideas have to come from the external world. An idea is just the same as a concept. A concept is something I can think of. Like, I suppose I say, I have a sense something is green. You can take green as a concept. It's something that can be applied to items in the external world. It's an idea. So in Rand's view, all concepts come from the empirical world. We get all the concepts from the senses. At least ultimately, we might construct higher level concepts once we have concepts derived from something. We have to start with concepts derived from the senses. And there aren't any innate ideas. Remember, Descartes and people in his tradition think that the mind comes equipped with certain ideas that it doesn't get from experience. You need experience, according to Descartes, to trigger certain ideas. But in his view, say I have an innate idea of a triangle, then suppose I see a triangle for the first time, that might trigger the innate idea, and I'll have the concept of a triangle consciously. So Rand doesn't accept that. She thinks we have to derive the concept from some kind of sense perception. Now, how does it do that? Well, we'll be going into that in a little more detail later in the lecture, but basically, the senses perceive similarities and differences among entities. For example, supposing I see various red colored objects. Suppose I see, say, there's a red tablecloth, a red pencil, red paint, red bucket of paint. So I can see how these, by the senses, I see how these various objects are similar, and I see how they're different from other objects. Let's say they're objects of different colors around these red objects. Well, let me see, somebody made a comment here. Let's see. Let me just see if I can read this here. Adam wants to know, is Cartesian innate idea similar to Platonic view? Yes, it is very similar. That's a very good point. Yes, you're right. Yes, and Charles is right that this is Rand's view, that if you imagine something, it comes from things that you learn through the senses. So, as I say, the senses are, you're seeing, we say, these similarities among the various red objects, and you're seeing at the same time that these red objects differ from objects of other colors. So you seem tend to see similarities and differences. So then in Rand view, the mind grasps what these entities have in common, namely in this case, the red color. And in the when you're seeing these various red objects, they'll all be slightly different. So each one will be a different slightly different shade of red, or different intensity. There'll be differences in the various rednesses that we see. But the mind will drop out these differences. She calls this measurement omission, and the mind will grasp what they have in common, namely their red color. So the result is an abstract idea or concept. So what do we mean by abstract idea? Well, it's one that isn't confined to these specific objects that I mentioned, red tablecloth, a red pencil, red bucket of paint. But once you have the idea of red, you've dropped out these measurements, these particular features of the various red objects, and I have an idea of red, and I can apply this to other instances of red that come up. So in that sense, it's abstract. It isn't confined to just particular instances of red. I have a general idea of red that I can now use to whenever some red object comes up. So then I can get, once I have caught these basic concepts that I get directly from the senses, I can come up with higher level concepts, like that, I get concepts of red, green, blue. I can see what do all these have in common. I can grasp their similarities and differences. Say then I could come up with a concept of color, which is a higher level concept. So you could build up a whole structure of concepts in this way. Now, that's the basics. The theory of concept is the fundamental principle of her theory of knowledge. In her the only book she wrote, strictly on philosophy, is Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, which I mentioned last time. Everyone should try to get if you can. It's available very inexpensively. So she thought this was so important. The only book she wrote on philosophy was about this theory of concepts. Now, so the theory of concepts is the basic thing in Rand's epistemology. Now, we have to then get, what about her theory of metaphysics? And here, the basic idea is the law of identity. A is A. Now, this is the basic principle. You probably, if you've taken logic, I gave a course in logic some time ago, I'm sure you've heard of the law of identity, just that everything is what it is. That's something very difficult to quarrel with. Suppose you say, your computer is your computer. How would you deny that? And you would have connected to this the law of non-contradiction. So it can't be the case that your computer is your computer, and at the same time your computer isn't your computer. That wouldn't make sense. So everything is what it is. Now you might think, you can't, all right, that's fine, but you can't get very much out of that. But Rand definitely didn't agree. She thought you could get a whole metaphysics really out of the law of identity. One of the things we'll be doing in this lecture, one of the most important things we have to consider, is to what extent was she correct about this? Is what she says about the law of identity really correct or not? Do we need to revise what she said? If in her view that the causal properties of an object are part of its identity, supposing, say, the earth has the cause a property, but being able to attract objects toward it because of gravity. So there's a causal property of the Earth that can get objects to attract objects toward it. If you throw a ball up in the air, it'll fall to the Earth because of gravity. So these causal properties in objects are part of its identity. And can you see why the causal properties of an object are part of its identity? Well, this is very easy because all the properties of an object are part of its identity. So because, remember, A is A, so if an object has certain properties, then it has those properties. If, say, the Earth has the property of being able to attract objects to it, then it has that property. That's part of its identity. So she gets from this, supposing something causes something else on a particular occasion, like, let's say, to take my example, I throw the ball up in the air and it falls to the Earth. So under exactly the same conditions, then if I throw the ball up again, it will fall to the Earth again. So if something causes something else on one occasion, it will always do so under the same condition. So she says, this is part of the law of this is the consequence of the law of identity. If you say this is the causal properties of private objects, so then its causal properties will always be the same part of its identity. Now, except for human choice, and we have to consider what happens to human choices a little later, all the properties of an object are necessary. What does that mean? They couldn't have been otherwise. So suppose we say, well, let's stick with our example. The Earth has certain causal properties that can attract objects to it. So not only is it the case that the Earth has that property in the actual world, but it couldn't have been otherwise. There couldn't have been circumstances in which the Earth didn't have that property. So all the properties of an object are necessary. I hate people who call during my lecture. I'm not going to answer that. I hope something bad happens to whoever called me because he interrupted. Whatever it was, interrupted my concentration. That's just not to be done. Okay, so that was a joke. You're supposed to laugh. All right. Now, so all the properties of an object are necessary. They couldn't have been otherwise. Now, another thing Rand says follows from law of identity, A is A, is nothing comes into existence without a cause. Let's imagine, like they say, we're looking in the sky, and you suddenly see a big teapot in the sky. And then you try to figure out how did the teapot get there, and the answer is it wasn't caused to get there by anything. It just came there for one moment. It wasn't there, and then it just happened to appear. It didn't have a cause. Rand doesn't think that's possible. She says whatever comes into existence has to have a cause. Now, as I mentioned, she thinks that human choices are not necessary. That's the only thing that is not necessary. Supposing human beings have free will and our choices aren't the inevitable results of previous conditions. Say, each of you had a choice to listen to my lecture or not to listen to it. It wasn't that something, for those of you who are here, something was forcing you or determining that you would listen to my lecture. And for those who didn't attend, that they weren't, there was nothing compelling them not to attend it. You each had a choice of listening to the lecture. And how do we know that we have choices? How do we know we have free will? Well, she says this is given in experience. We just know that we choose experience. It's not something we have to prove, but we have it in experience. So if we were to deny it, we'd be denying an aspect of reality. We'd be saying we don't have free choice, but it's given in reality that we have free choice. Now, she also gave the argument, what happens if we deny that we have free will? Suppose I say, no, I don't think I have free will. I think suppose somebody said, well, I think the arguments for determinism are pretty convincing. Even if we think we have free will, we really don't. So she, Rand, and philosophers who are in the Randian tradition, like Leonard Peikoff, David Kelly, said, well, if determinism were true, then the fact that we're denying free will is also determined. I say, I don't believe in free will. My saying I don't believe in free will is always determined. So then we wouldn't have reason to think our denial of determinism is true, because it would just be that we're determined to say that. We wouldn't have reason to think that it's true. It would just be something that's causing us to say that. Now, I'm not going to go into it here. There's some question whether that argument is correct. It's given in there. It seems to have a bit of a problem. Can anyone see what the problem is with the argument? Anybody? I see you're all clamoring to give objections. Oh, wait, there's somebody. Oh, wait, I'm missing. Well, I was missing things that people have put in. Now, Charles wants me to restate the problem. Okay. Well, the problem is I was missing a lot of message. Well, the basic problem is that supposing that, in fact, I say I don't have free will, suppose I was determined to say that, does it follow that I'm not responding to arguments in saying that? Suppose I say, well, there are various arguments in favor of determinism, and I accept those, so that's why I'm in favor of determinism. I'm not actually supporting that, but I would imagine that I was. And I say, well, such and such arguments have convinced me that determinism is correct. So is that inconsistent with saying that something was causing me to accept determinism? It isn't clear that there's a contradiction there. Some people think there is, obviously, Rand, but it isn't clear what the contradiction is supposed to be. Okay, so I should say just one side point on that. Murray Rothbard got into trouble because of this particular argument, that he wrote an essay called The Mantle of Science that you may have read. I recommend that. It's a very good essay. And he endorsed this argument that if you deny free will, you're contradicting yourself in this way. But according to the objectivist, he got this argument from Barbara Brandon's master's thesis and didn't give her credit. So the people in the Rand circle raised a terrific to-do about this, and Rothbard responded that this was actually a very common argument. It wasn't one the objectivists invented. You find it in all sorts of previous philosophies. We had a lot of quotations to show this, and one person who actually gave the argument was Immanuel Kant, who was Rand's main enemy. But basically, the thing I want to stress now is that Rand strongly believed in free will. And according to her, the fundamental choice that we have is the choice to think, or as she called it, to focus. So what the primary exercise of our free will is, we can choose whether we want to think or not. If we think properly, then we'll be able to perceive reality accurately, not be subject to distorting ideas. Jerry Weinstein, was this the beginning of the Rand-Rosberg food fight? It was. There were other things as well, but this is one of the main causes of this. There's all sorts of interesting details about it, such as that von Mises wrote Rothbard a letter supporting him. Now we've sketched the basic, given outline of Rand's system. I want to get into the more controversial part of today's lecture. This is the part where I hope people don't start shooting at me. But what are some of the problems of the objectivist position? We want to go through the arguments and see to what extent are they right. Now, if we try to evaluate the views we just covered, I think we face a basic problem, is that what you usually have in a philosophy book, you'll find someone giving a thesis and giving all sorts of arguments in favor of the thesis. You might disagree with the arguments, but you'll at least have a lot of arguments. But generally, objectivists offer very few arguments to support what they say. What they'll usually do, and they're very good at this, is they're very careful at how they set up the objectivist views. They're very good at explaining exactly what Rand is saying on a particular point. And if you look at probably the two philosophers who've written on Rand as a systematic thinker, Leonard Peikoff and David Kelly, you know, Peikoff's book I'd originally tried to assign one objective to philosophy by Rand, but we found that there are problems in Googling this book. It was hard for people to get online. So I found the other one as the only text, one by Thomas and Kelly on the structure of objectivism. But if you look at either of those books, they both spend a great deal of time showing how objectivism can be presented systematically. They'll try to show what is the best way to present the doctrines, what is the correct order you should use in to best understand the objectivist doctrine. Peikoff says he spent years thinking about how the structure should be presented, and David Kelly has a very elaborate chart showing how various objectivist doctrines are related to one another. But, and you'll have to test this out by your own reading, they don't say too much about why we should accept these views. They sometimes have replies to objections, but they don't really give arguments in favor. So I think that's a fundamental problem, that they'll just state a certain position and not really tell you why you should support it. In some sense, you could say, well, okay, here is your system, but what if I reject it? What if I don't accept it? But I think we can see some, let's see, somebody has put a comment here. Yes, Neil says that objectivists don't get around to even counter. Sometimes they do attempt to reply to objections, but they generally don't say too much as to defending their own positions too much. They'll just, I guess they strike them as to objectivists, these positions seem pretty evident. Now, I want to go through then, we'll go through some of the doctrines they have to see to what extent we should accept them, what extent the arguments for them are good ones, to the extent they have arguments. Now, someone said, doesn't grant everything comes from the axioms, and the axioms are self-evident. Well, we'll see that'll be an issue we'll be covering right now what they mean, what that means by action. So that's a very good question that Alexander has raised. Now, one thing I think the objectivists seem clearly right about is that the external world exists. It seems, suppose somebody said, well, I don't think there is an external world, say, I think only I exist, or say we're all, I'm nothing, but we're dreaming that there's an external world, there's no external world. That seems like a very odd position. Couldn't we say, well, we know that there is an external world. You know that you're now listening to me lecture. You probably wish you weren't, but you know that you are. You know that there is an external world. So we can call the existence of the world, and a lot of some analytic philosophers call this a Moorean fact, after the British philosopher G.E. Moore, who was a professor at Cambridge for in the 1930s, 40s, and he started his philosophical career in the late 19th century. I think he lived to around 1958. He's one of the greatest British philosophers. So what he said is that our certainty that the world exists outweighs any skeptical arguments to the contrary. You probably heard skeptical arguments, let's suppose they say something like, well, supposing we were all brains in a vat being manipulated by scientists to have exactly the experiences we're having now, how do we know that isn't happening? Because by the hypothesis, any experience we have now would be duplicated by the scientists. They'd be giving us exactly the experiences we're having now. So how could I say that anything could refute this skeptical hypothesis that we're just brains in a vat imagining that we're seeing an external world? So what Moore style response to this argument would be saying, well, even if we can't spot what's wrong with these arguments, what's wrong with skeptical arguments, we can still reject them. There must be something wrong with them because we know that the world exists. So I think I find that a very plausible view. So here I think Rand seems right that we do know there's an external world. So she's right to defend the primacy of existence in the way that she does. But I think that objectivists read too much into the existence of the external world. Now, one thing they say is, both Kimberly agreeing with them, think that the objectivists are right, the external world exists. Wait, there's a comment here by Jerry, let me read it. Peacock refers to the hierarchical progression, and one principle leads to the other. Well, that's right that the Peacock does say that, but there'd be the question of should you accept the first principle. But I don't think, I think what's really happening in this hierarchical progression is just an array, it shows that there's a consistent system, but you can reject the entire system, at least certain parts of it. So I don't think you will have to look at some of these doctrines. That's what we're trying to do in Russia. But I don't think they're able to show that if you accept, say, the first point, then you're going to accept all the others. If you accept one point in this spiral, you're committed to all the others. Or even if they're right that that's the case, you have a question, why should you accept any of the points at least taken the way they wanted to read them? I mean, you could say, well, sure, we should accept that the external world exists, but does what they say follow from accepting that really follow? Now, one thing I think doesn't follow that they think does is that we directly grasps the external world with the senses. Suppose I say that I'm now looking at a computer screen. So what objectivists would say is they've got a position of it's called direct realism. What I'm really looking at is a computer screen. I'm not looking at some sort of image of a computer screen in my mind. Now, I think there's a lot to be said for this position of direct realism, but the point I want to make now, that position, direct realism, doesn't follow from accepting that there's an external world. We have the question, once we say there is an external world, how do we perceive it? So there's then the question, well, some people say we don't perceive the world directly, is what the position called indirect or critical realism would say, oh, we really see or sense data rather than actual external objects. So somebody could say that quite consistently with saying that the external world exists. So it wouldn't be a question someone has written to me, question ignoring the external world would just be saying, well, what's the nature of our perception of the external world? That would be something that would still have to be established. So all I'm saying now doesn't follow from the fact that it really exists, that we have to accept this particular view of it. And I should say, the objectivist view that we directly see the world, direct realism, doesn't commit them to saying that perception is transparent. It isn't their view that when we're seeing something, our senses sort of copy reality as it actually is. It's more that they reject that view. They call this diaphanous view of perception, something that you can see through. They say, well, supposing let's take our case of the red object, let's look at a red bucket of paint. It isn't that, in their view, that the bucket of paint has the sort of perceived, really has the red shade that we're perceiving in it. That's something that comes about from the interaction of our senses and nervous system with the bucket. So what the object has is just emitting certain light waves. When these light waves come into contact with us, we see a red image, but they're not holding, they don't think that this red shade, this color that we're seeing is really there in the object. So it isn't as if their direct realism is one that say objects really have all the properties that are they're perceived to have. It's just that we're really interacting with the object in some way. So it's direct realism in that sense. What I was contending is that view may very well be true, but it doesn't follow just from saying that the external world exists. It's an additional doctrine. So one thing I think we have to be careful of is that the objectivist will sometimes pack into something that's very difficult to reject, like that the external world exists. They'll say, well, then this somehow commits you to all sorts of other views, but it might not. There's a question here. Alexander says, wouldn't the sense data we have be of the object? He says, well, they would be caused by the object, but it might, in the view of people who believe in sense data, they wouldn't be the object. They would be intermediaries between us and the object. So that's what direct realism is rejected. Now let's see, there's some more questions. Someone says David Kelly has written on evidence of senses. Yes, that's a very good book. I recommend that. I did a review of that for the International Philosophical Quarterly. Kelly sent me a very nice letter about it. So I do recommend you read that book. Now, I want to raise now, so far I haven't raised much of a difficulty with the doctrine of primacy of existence. I just said, well, you don't have to accept direct realism about perception. If you accept the primacy of existence, that isn't an argument that you shouldn't accept direct realism. It's just that it doesn't follow from accepting the fact that the external world exists. Now, one thing I think is when we say the primacy of existence, what we mean by that is the external world confronts us in a way. Say, suppose you say you're seeing me lecture now. That isn't something that's under your control. You can turn away or go somewhere else, but you can't control my speaking just by thinking. Suppose you're thinking, well, I don't like what he's saying. That isn't going to stop me just by changing our thoughts. It's not changing reality. But one thing I think that the really objectivists go wrong, or at least I'm thinking that, is that, and actually someone is anticipating my point, is that nothing follows from this about the nature of the external world. That is what the world consists of. So the primacy of existence is consistent with idealist views that the world really consists of mental substances, or partly mental substances. So supposing, say, as Bishop Berkeley did, you think there's no such thing as matter. All that exists is ideas. Now, that's consistent with thinking that we can't change the world just by changing our thought. Supposing, like Bishop Berkeley would say, of course, he lived before computers were invented, but suppose he said, well, when you're now looking at a computer screen, what you're really seeing consists entirely of ideas. But it doesn't follow from that that you can change the ideas you're seeing just by thinking about these ideas in a different way. So what Berkeley was doing is just giving an analysis of what physical objects, what objects consist of, I shouldn't say physical objects, but he's not denying that there are objects in the world that confront us, so he's not denying that we can, he's not saying we construct the ideas just out of our thought, so it's just the world is given to us, but this doesn't commit us to any particular view of what the external world consists of. I'm not defending this idealist view. There are philosophers, contemporary philosophers, who do hold that. It's a very much minority view. A very good book I'd recommend, like John Foster, a very good British philosopher, called The Case for Idealism, where he gives very elaborate arguments in favor of idealism. But what I just want to point out now is that this view, namely that the external world consists of ideas, isn't in contradiction with accepting the primacy of existence. Of course, Rand would say it is, because she wants to say if you accept the existence of the external world, then you have to accept the external world is composed of matter, not of mental substances. But this doesn't follow all the primacy of existence means that we can't change the world just by thinking about it. But that doesn't tell us what the world consists of. Now, related to this, the primacy of existence doesn't rule out creation of the world by God. Rand thought it did, because then we'd be saying that the physical world is then just under control, is created by God, so it's subordinate to God, who's an immaterial substance in the usual conception. But here again, it isn't that God's thinking, if he creates the world, is identical with the world. It's that he's created an actual world that's not, it isn't that then that his thinking is something that's constructing the world. Creation is actually something that takes place. What's exactly saying that creation is a very difficult problem, but that view doesn't directly contradict the primacy of existence in the way how would the objectivists respond to these criticisms? Well, they would say that the criticism I've given rests on misunderstanding. Their view isn't that the fact the world is composed of not matter, non-mental substance, and that the world hasn't been created by God. These are not logical deductions from an axiom called the primacy of existence. So it isn't, as I was saying, well, okay, you start with the primacy of existence and the external world confronts us. And I was saying, well, look, it doesn't follow from that that God doesn't exist or that the world is composed of matter. So I think this doesn't follow. So the objection would say, well, look, when I say that, I'm misunderstanding objectivism because they don't say there are a lot of these things are logical deductions from the axiom. They say the primacy of existence is just an inductive generalization of facts like the world is composed of matter and that God doesn't exist. So it isn't that I deduce these from some sort of axiom that just the primacy of existence. On the contrary, the axiom is a generalization of these other things. But then the question, of course, would be, how do we know these facts? How do we know that God doesn't exist? How do we know that the external world is composed of matter? So the question would be, again, how are we supposed to know this? We can't both say, well, the primacy of existence is just because of the primacy of existence. That would be a circular argument. Now, I want to raise another problem before I turn away from the primacy of existence. And this is, suppose we accept, as I think we should, the existence of the world as a Murian fact. I say, well, it's just there. We know we're sure that the world exists. So there must be something wrong with skeptical arguments to the contrary. This doesn't tell us what's wrong with skeptical arguments. And some skeptical arguments are very challenging because they start from commonly accepted premises and don't have obvious flaws. To return to the example I gave earlier, suppose we were nothing but brains in a vat and were manipulated by scientists. Have exactly the experience we now have. So how do we know that this isn't happening if, by the hypothesis, any experience we have in the actual world is duplicated by the scientist? So what exactly is wrong with the argument? And just saying, well, there must be something wrong with it doesn't tell us that. The objectivist answer here would be that thought experiments of the kind I've just given are illegitimate. But then we would want to know, well, why do they think that? I think the answer is we can see from their theory of concepts. We'll get into that a bit later. We see here, and I just want to point out that if we accept the external world exists, this doesn't really dispose of the skeptical arguments. Now, I want to now go on to what I think are some problems with the objectivist use of the law of identity, A is A. Now, the law of identity is that just as everything has whatever features it has, say, suppose you say one of my properties is that I'm the idiot who's obtusely rejecting Randian views, then that's one of my properties. But it doesn't follow from the law of identity that everything has a fixed nature in the sense of a persisting identity in time. Let's imagine, I'm not getting this hypothesis I accept, because I'm just asking to imagine. Suppose everything kept changing randomly, or if you think that change presupposes that something remains the same, just imagine that there were momentary existence, just things that exist for a moment, like a particle at a particular moment. And then these existences were constantly randomly replaced by other things. So you just have sort of random points, each one, next second you'll have other random points. That's perfectly consistent with the law of identity. The law of identity just says the thing has whatever properties it has. It doesn't say that everything has a fixed nature, a persisting identity. Similarly, the law of identity tells us that if something has causative powers, then it has those powers. It doesn't imply that objects, in fact, have causative powers. Suppose I say something like, suppose you say something like, you have the power to put your fist through the computer screen right now. Well, then you have that power, but it doesn't, the law of identity doesn't say that you have that particular power or any other powers. It doesn't have any saying about that. And another point is that suppose an object does have causal powers, these don't have to be such that they always operate in the same way. Now imagine a case where this particular object had the power either to cause A or B, which one happened was random. Like, let's imagine I have the power, say if I move my hand in a certain way, and I'm get this on the screen, suppose I move my hand to the right, it will cause either that I win the lottery or there's a nuclear explosion at the North Pole, one of the two, but it randomly, so moving my hand will have the consequence either I win the lottery or there's a nuclear explosion at the North Pole. That's consistent with the law of identity, just as someone's asked a question. We're going to be dealing with some of these points that people raise a little later. So let's imagine there's no causation at all in the world, just things just happen completely randomly, nothing gives rise to anything else. That's perfectly consistent with the law of identity. The law of identity just says a thing has whatever properties it does have. It doesn't say that it has fixed properties or it has properties of a causal kind. Now, again, objectivists say that nothing can come into existence without a cause. Let's imagine what is supposed to be the contradiction there. Let's imagine that in my case, a teapot suddenly comes into existence. It didn't have a cause. How does this violate this law of non-contradiction? What's supposed to be the contradiction there? I should say, the British philosopher Elizabeth Anscombe, let me just put her name down here. Wrote an article once suggesting that if something came into existence without, we would never have good reason to think something came into existence without a cause. So she didn't contend it's a contradiction. She said, "Oh, we never have good reason to accept this." And I wrote an article replying to her called Anscombe on Coming into Existence and Causation. It was one of my first philosophical articles that came out in the Analysis, which was a British philosophy magazine in 1979. I just thought I'd throw that in. Why not? So, again, what's supposed to be the contradiction in thinking something can come into existence without a cause? Well, what I think objectivists would answer for this question, why can't something come into existence without a cause, and for these previous suppositions that the world is just changing randomly, is that if there were no, without constant properties and causation, then there'd be no reason for events would take place. We would just have random occurrences. There'd be no reason in things. But I think they had a good point there. They said that. But what they'd be appealing to there is what Leibniz called the principle of sufficient reason. Leibniz thought whenever something happens, there must be a reason that explains it. But that's not the same as the law of identity. In fact, Leibniz said, well, you can't show that the principle of sufficient reason objectivist pack in great Neoclinius Principles of Sufficient Reason into the law of identity, and there'd be the question why we should accept what they say follows from the law of identity. It seems like they're packing a lot of controversial stuff into that. Again, how would the objectivist answer what I've said so far? Now, they've said, in fact, they have said this to me. I've had exchanges with convinced objectivists. Like there was one, Bill Dwyer, who's a very good objectivist philosopher, who said that I'm using an incorrect rationalist conception of philosophy. So what my criticisms are based on asking, well, what deductively follows from the formal principle A is A? I'm saying, well, look, all the things they say about things having fixed nature don't, in fact, follow from this formal principle. So what they would answer is they don't view axioms this way, it's kind of just principles that are purely formal, let's say A is A, and then claim that things logically follow by strict formal deduction from this principle. They say, no, the law of identity is an inductive generalization, so what's given, in fact, is that objects do have these fixed natures, and then the law of identity really sums up these various facts that I said are controversial, like that nothing comes into existence without a cause, and objects have their whatever properties they have necessarily. So law of identity really summing up all these things. It isn't that we're deducing these from some sort of formal principle, so my criticisms are wrong. But then, once more, the question would be, why should we then accept the law of identity if the objectivist conceive it? It seems insane if you say, well, I reject the law of identity, it's a basic law of thought. But what the objectivists do is, the way they take the law of identity, it's a quite controversial view. It isn't just a straightforward logical principle. Now, one side point here, suppose we accept, as the objectivists do, that all entities have a fixed nature. Now, does it follow from this and say that all objects have a fixed nature, that God doesn't exist? Leonard Peikoff thinks that it does follow. He says everything has a fixed nature, so God can't exist, because he says God is supposed to be an infinite being. But an infinite being has no fixed nature, so God can't exist, because remember, we're now assuming all entities have a fixed nature. But this doesn't seem to be correct, because why should we say that God doesn't have a fixed nature? And a fixed nature, at least it's not obvious to me, a fixed nature doesn't have to be one that's limited in power or knowledge. God is supposed to be omnipotent or omniscient, he can do anything that's logically possible, he knows everything, but those properties don't seem to be just part of his nature if he exists. It isn't that those properties are somehow inconsistent with having a fixed nature. And I see there's quite some dialogue going, and I'm running out of, I want to get through the rest of the slides, so I'll cover some of the points that you raised if you want in the discussion. Now, again, let's accept for the moment objective view that all entities in the world have a fixed nature. So all entities have certain essential properties. Let's even accept the objective view that all of an entity's properties are necessary. I say they couldn't have been otherwise. So, say, suppose we find that light travels at 186,000 miles per second, then it's a defining characteristic of light that it travels at that speed. So it couldn't be the case that light travels at a different speed. The speed that has in the we find that is an essential property of it. But it doesn't follow from that light had to exist. That's to say, You see, the point is kind of has subtle points. Let's go over it again. In other words, if we say an object has all of its properties essentially, it couldn't be that object unless it had all the properties that it does have. That doesn't say the object had to exist. There couldn't have been certain things in which it didn't exist. So what the objectivists think is that light and everything else that exists must exist because everything that exists must exist except for human choices. Whatever exists in the actual world had to exist except for human choices. We couldn't imagine circumstances in which it didn't. So what they say is in the philosophical jargon, we imagine various possible worlds that we imagine. Let's imagine, say, the actual world, the world where I'm giving this lecture, has changed so that everything is the same, but I'm not giving the lecture, you're doing something else. And say, many people say, well, that's a possible world, the world where I'm not giving the lecture now. So the objectivists wouldn't accept that. They say, well, the actual world, the one that is really the case, is the only possible world. But this seems a very implausible view. We really want to say that it's what in fact exists must exist. Now, suppose someone says, well, had things been slightly different, the Earth might not have existed. Say, had certain events in the solar system been somewhat different, the Earth might not have existed. Is this something that's senseless to say that? The objectivists would say it is because since the world is not, the Earth now exists, so it has to exist. The way events are in the actual world is the only way they could have been. But that seems, at least to me and to most people written on necessity and possibility, seems an implausible view. It would certainly require a great deal of argument to show why we should accept it. Now, let's stick for a moment to the actual world. Many philosophers think that entities have some essential properties, but that not all of the properties in entity are essential. I think that seems like a very plausible view. You'd say something like, well, a table has to be composed of some physical material in order to be a table, but something could be a table and say, just have very short legs or long legs. The particular properties of the table aren't essential to it. The objectivists wouldn't say that tables have to have legs of particular length. They would say this particular table had to have the exact legs that it did have. Well, maybe that isn't the best example because they say that involves the human choice. Well, let's take some object, say a particular mountain. They would say, well, the mountain has to have all the features necessarily that it does have. So the objectivists make all properties part of an object definition so that it's part of the definition of a cat then that it likes milk just because cats in the actual world tend to like milk. Now, these views, as I said, that object has all its properties necessarily, that whatever exists in the actual world has to exist, they're at odds with those of most people. So question comes up, well, why do the objectivists adopt those views? And here I think the key is Rand's theory of concepts. We don't have a concept of a possible world different from the actual world. Because remember, in Rand's theory of concepts, we get our concepts by abstraction from the senses. We perceive similarities and differences of things. So how could our senses put us in touch with anything other than the actual world? But I think this really underlies why the objectivists hold these particular views about necessity that I've gone over. So then the question comes, well, should we accept Rand's theory of concepts? And here, I think we'll encounter a problem that I mentioned earlier in the lecture, is that they don't give very many, the objectors don't give very much in the way of arguments for the theory. If you look at Introduction and Objections to Epistemology, it gives a very detailed and careful account of the theory of concept and responds to various objections to it. But there aren't really arguments saying why this is the correct theory of concept. It's just really, here's how we get concepts, and we agree. Elaborate explanation with, but they don't give, say, one with beauty. They don't think we have any ideas, but they don't show why we have those. Now let's see. Now someone, Randy, says the essential nature of that particular thing doesn't mean a concept has to have all essential features defined. Well, but it isn't that the concept of a cat has to have all the essential features defined, but each particular cat has all the properties that it has, essentially. You see the difference there. And that's a very good question there. So all the properties that particular things have are essential to it. It couldn't have had other properties than the one that that thing actually has, but you're right, it doesn't follow that the concept cat, taken as a general term, has to have all the properties of a particular cat. You thought you had them there, didn't you? But I'm very good at evading objections. Okay, now, in just conclusion, I'll mention some problems with the theory of concept, other than the fact that there's not much in the way of argument given for it, is in the Rand's view, remember, we grasp similarities and differences among entities, and then we abstract concepts. So the question comes up, well, if we could do that, if we get from grasp similarities and differences, say if I could see imagine these red, various red objects, we have a red bucket of paint, red pencil, red tablecloth. I could see grasp all the different, not only that they're all red, but all the different shades of red that they have. Don't we already have the concept before? I mean, how can we say, well, we're getting the concept by abstracting it if we already grasp the similarities and differences? Don't we have a more detailed account of the concept already? What Rand seems to be doing is giving us a way of getting from a more complicated concept to a simpler concept. And how do we get the more complicated concept? And how do we get this concept of all the various shades of red with their differences and similarities? Now, what the objectivists would answer is that this objection that I've given rests on a mistake. They say, well, we don't need concepts to grasp similarities and differences. We grasp this through the senses. And David Kelly has a very good technical article on abstraction, Rand's theory of concepts, where he stresses that similarities have to be perceived in contrast to differences. But even if he's right about that the senses do that, then the question would still be, well, how are we supposed to get a concept out of all this? Say the senses are getting these similarities and differences, then how is this abstraction supposed to proceed? It's not entirely clear. Now, question then comes up in responding to, I said, well, the objectivists don't really tell us why we should accept their theory of concept. Sometimes objectivists will say, well, if we don't accept their theory of concept, then we have no guarantee their concepts agree with reality. Suppose if we don't get concepts by abstraction of the senses, well, how do we know they're true? Suppose I have certain innate ideas I didn't get by concept of the senses. Maybe these innate ideas wouldn't correspond to anything in reality. But here I think there's a basic mistake, is that it isn't that concepts are true or false, it's propositions. The proposition is saying that something is the case. When I say cats like milk, that's a proposition. The concept of a cat isn't a proposition, it's just an idea, something we've been thinking about. So long long as we can find out if a proposition is true, that's really all we need. We don't need to ground concepts and percepts to guarantee truth, as long as we can have ways of finding out whether the proposition is true. At least that's what it seems to me. Well, I warned you this is the most difficult lecture, so I hope that I want to thank everybody who stayed with me for the lecture. Now, for the rest of the time, we'll have questions, objections. Anything else? Now, Jerry wants to know, how can you respond to criticism of your philosophy without, in that process, offering arguments in favor of your position? Well, that's an excellent question, Jerry. You see, you're certainly right that if you respond to a criticism, you've given an argument in favor, namely that this particular criticism is false. But suppose you respond to, let's say you respond to all these criticisms correctly, then there'd be still a question why you should adopt this particular theory. Supposing, say, all the criticism I raised of Rand's theory of concepts are wrong, let's say she's responded adequately, objection philosophy's responded adequately to all these criticisms, then you still have the question, well, what are the arguments in favor of the particular view? So you would still, responding to criticism isn't the point. Well, I was wondering if David Kelly is not the David Kelly who is the author of the sentence. If I'm not surprised to hear that, I don't think the real David Kelly would need to take a lecture course from me about objectivism. He's one of the top authorities and he wouldn't agree with what I say anyway.
Dr. Gordon?
Yes.
There's a Q&A section. There's a few posts there. You can access them. Do you see where it says the Q&A panel?
Yes.
There's
yes.
a little gray bar.
Yes, I do.
If you click on that, there's a few posts from Dylan.
Oh, well, let's see what happens. Okay, I clicked on it. Let's see if anything's happening. Wait, am I clicking on the wrong one here? Is it, there's a question mark. Maybe I click on the question mark.
Click on the triangle.
Oh, the triangle. Oh, I see. Where it says expand the panel?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, here's, now I'm seeing things. Dylan says, infinity is an abstraction, a word describing the universe that does exist, is
Also, let me just remind people to let's just use the chat in general. Let's not also use the Q&A, just to keep things simple.
Yeah. Dylan, as I understand your questions, you're giving reasons that we should reach that the existence of the world is more plausible than the existence of God. But you see, I wasn't giving arguments in favor of the existence of God. All I was doing was questioning whether these objectivist arguments are supposed to show there's some kind of something conceptually wrong with the notion, the idea of God, or correct. So I wasn't attempting to address a very difficult question whether there were good or bad arguments for existence of God. That would be a very, let's say you say if God can be uncaused, the universe can be. Well, I wasn't addressing that sort of argument here. That's a very interesting point. But all I was trying to do was respond to arguments that there's some sort of conceptual impropriety in the concept of an infinite being, namely that the infinite being wouldn't have a fixed nature, and I don't see why that's supposed to be true. And the other argument I mentioned was to say, well, if you think the world was created by God, then you're denying the primacy of existence. And I think if that was the case, you wouldn't be saying that the world was constructed out of thought. You'd be saying, no, God this non-physical being that's created the world. Now, I imagine everybody's against what I've said here in the lecture. Let me ask if I may, how many of the people here are basically call themselves objectivists or sympathizers? If someone has asked the question here, someone has asked here, John has a quick question that anyone might know the answer. Wait, what is the point here? I'm not seeing it. I was a star of religion. John was started by Rand States about religion and Christianity. Did Rand attempt to answer the question, how do we get here, why there's something rather than nothing? Well, what she said on this is that, I'm glad you asked the question, it's a basic point in the objectivist system. Remember, they say nothing can come into existence without a cause. So suppose we say we're looking at the physical world, and we say that there's it has certain ultimate constituents, say we just find that's as far as you can go. So what happens then? Well, those ultimate constituents couldn't have a cause because they're the ultimate constituents. They're what the world is made of. Let's imagine that we're going to find all these subatomic particles. We just come to some, there's nothing underlying these, the ultimate particles. So then they couldn't have come into existence without a cause, but there they are, so then they have to exist eternally. So according to Rand, the question, why is there something rather than nothing, wouldn't make sense, because the notion of nothing, absolute nothing, doesn't make sense. We could only have, nothing in the sense of something, an absence of a particular thing, but there couldn't be absolute nothing. There's always something that exists. So she would reject that question, but it's a very good question that you ask. Let me see anybody. Now we have some who say they're sympathized. Confession. Oh, we have good Rothbardian. Oh, good. Well, I hope the ones who are objectivist don't. I hope you still stay in my course. I wouldn't want people. Yes, I mean, I don't think anyone, John, I don't think anyone took your question antagonistic. I certainly did. I'm in trouble. Now, Charles says A is A at this instant, but sometimes later A may change into B, and there's a reason that it did. My task is to learn why A became B. You see, then there'd be the question, suppose you say there's a reason that A changed into B, then if you say that, well, you're accepting the principle of sufficient reason, but then the question would be, does that principle, namely if something happens, there's a reason for it, follow from the law of identity? We might very well want to accept this principle of sufficient reason, but it's a different question. Is that just a follow from A is A? You see the difference. Anil asked, here has a couple of questions. What measurements are omitted with concepts such as and not justice? Well, Rand discusses that in the objectivist epistemology. In the second edition, there is a question that various people asked her. And she thinks on and not, we get that as abstractions. We would get the and would be abstract from cases where we're presented with the contents of two more things together, so we get the notion of things being presented together. A knot is a difficult one for abstractionist theories, but she would, I guess, get that through some kind of notion of thinking that, say, getting a certain content, and then we wouldn't, say, no longer be seeing that particular content, looking at a red object, and the object disappears, so I would grasp the difference between the object was present and absent, so we might get not from that. And justice, I think she gets that. She has a very elaborate account of how we get justice within the book. I think you should have a look at that. So that's not something we directly get from the senses, but we get it something like things, or you get the notion of something being rightly ordered. You get that kind of an abstract concept that would be kind of higher up in the hierarchy. Now, and the second question we have, if there's no a priori logic, how do objectivists explain the objectivity of math and logic? Related to this, Rand said the introduction to objectivist cosmology of axiomatic concepts are known to be true because you can't escape and are implicit in all knowledge. Isn't this the kind of argument philosophers use to justify a priori reasons? Well, I think what she would say, she does say this about math and logic, that the mathematical principles are inductive generalizations from experience. What you remember the fundamental essay by Peacock that I spoke about last week called The Analytic Synthetic Dichotomy. What they think is there isn't a separate kind of truth that's for analytic truth or truth just because of the meaning of terms. I suppose I say all bachelors are male, all bachelors are men. Some philosophers say, well, that's analytic. It's just part of the definition of bachelor is a man. But the objectivists don't recognize a separate kind of truth called truth of meaning as opposed to truths about the world. And similarly, they don't recognize sort of a priori truth that we just get by experience rather than truths that are generalization to think about. They would say, well, mathematical truths are just truths that we get by experience. Remember, we say, well, what is the inescapable part? You know, everything in the world is, in the actual world, is necessary. So they would think that there really isn't a basic difference between 2 + 2 = 4 and saying the solar system has 9 planets, or maybe it's been changing now, they got rid of Pluto, that has whatever number of planets it does have. That's equally a necessary statement. Okay, now, Jerry said, wait, let me see this. Jerry has a bibliography on the atheism. Well, I'll tell you a very funny story, if you don't mind, on the atheism arguments. You know, when, I think someone asked earlier, I think Jerry was it you, on why Rand and Rothbard had split. And one of the reasons for the split, in addition to that point on the argument from determinism that I mentioned before, is that Mary Rothbard's wife, Joey Rothbard, was a Christian. She was a Presbyterian. And the objectivists didn't like that. They thought, well, a rational person should be an atheist. So they wanted Joey Rothbard to listen to Nathaniel Grandin's tapes for giving the atheist arguments. And she didn't want to do that. So they felt that if she refused to be convinced, Rothbard should separate from her. Of course, couldn't consider doing that. So that was actually one of the reasons that Rothbard split with them. Now, Joy said, she always assumed rambling reasons high value for the enterprise, individual and personal capability. Well, you were quite right in thinking that, but she did think those things. I hope I didn't say anything that suggested the contrary. Dylan says, why would math and logic be a priori? Math is observable. Well, those people who think that it is would think things like, would say things like this. Suppose I say 2 plus 2 equals 4. Well, I don't have to keep checking. I don't have to keep testing to see whether that's true. Once I grasp what it means, then I immediately grasp that it's true. So it's certainly, it's observable in the sense that we can see that if we put together 2 objects with 2 other objects, and we'll get 4 objects. But according to people who think math is a priori, suppose you just said, well, you put 2 objects together, got 2 or another 2, get 4 objects. People say, well, how would you know you get 4 objects if you did it again? What's the necessity of that? Now, the objection was to say, well, look, if you've done it correctly, then you know you will always get 4 objects. Remember, they think that this follows from the law of identity. So it's a basic difference there when you think inductive. If you think inductive generalizations from experience give you necessity, then you don't need to say that math and logic are a priori. But if you think, if you're doubtful about that, that's why people think, those people think it is a priori, think so. Justin thinks it's a duty inherent to ask the question how we got here. Well, in some sense, she'd accept that. I think she'd give a count on how human beings arrive, but she rejected the question, why is there something rather than nothing? I guess Jerry's right. There's other things, the objections that said about this. Now, Maureen said, why we have a question, but we're not going to address these questions. Which questions did you want me to address that I didn't? Or?
Oh, David, I've been pasting those questions into the chat, so you can just keep them in the chat. And Maureen's question is currently at the bottom.
Oh, I haven't got. Sorry, Maureen, I haven't gotten it to it yet. Don't worry. I won't ignore it. Leslie says the objective is divine law. Leslie wants to say, well, are the objectivists contradicting themselves because they say law of identity is self-evident, but it's also an inductive generalization? Well, I don't think they are contradicting themselves because they think that some inductive generalizations are evident once we understand them. So I think if they had to give up one or the other, they would give up the one about being self-evident. That they think that something can be very evident, like say the world, external world exists, it's something we can't deny, but it's something we learn from experience. It's not something we know just by thinking about the concept we explore. So what they're denying is that if something is self-evident, something is undeniable, then it can't be something that's learned from experience. They think experience can give us things that are undeniably true. Now, let's see if we can get to Maureen. Now, Jane said, if they say everything except human choices are necessary, does this lead to mysticism contradiction? Let me see. Let me give us an argument here. Uh,
For the benefit of our listeners, I'll just read the argument out loud, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah.
So he has premise one, the human body and all the physical world is composed of physical materials, such as atoms, the properties of which, including all their causal effects, are necessary and fixed, in brackets A equals A. Premise two, human consciousness and choices are not fixed. Humans have free will, the ability to respond differently under the same conditions. In brackets, consciousness is a primary. Premise three, it is not possible for the same physical entities to behave differently under the same circumstances. Brackets A equals A. Conclusion one, human consciousness and choices are not caused by the physical material of the human body or the physical world. Premise four, nothing exists without a cause unless it is primary and has always existed. Premise five, a human body is not a primary and that has always existed. Premise six, human consciousness and human choice cannot exist without a human body. In brackets, A equals A, existence exists. Conclusion two, human consciousness and choice have a cause. Turning conclusions one and two into premises. Premise seven, human consciousness and choice have a cause. Premise eight, human consciousness and choices are not caused by the physical material of the human body or the physical world. Conclusion three, something exists other than the physical world, which is mysticism and contradicts the primary that only existence exists.
Ah, well, that's a very interesting argument. I think the problem, and I have to go over it, it's very carefully constructed, but I think the problem there is that it wouldn't be the case that the objections would say of every primary always existed eternally. So they would just, I think, say that the human choice is primary, but it hasn't always existed. I don't think they would consider this mysticism, because mysticism for them is claiming that you can know certain things apart from the senses or without using reason. I don't think they would rate it as mysticism. I have to go through your argument very detail, but I think probably the way the objectors would attack it is it isn't the case that every primary exists eternally. Now let's see some of it. Now we got to Marine asked a question. See, I'm not neglecting you, Marine. How does one prove the choice to think it's real? Well, I think the objectors would say this is just something given in experience. We just get this from experience, there isn't a separate. They take that choice as primary, something that you don't explain in terms of something else that's just primary. Now, Dylan, let me see. We're running out of time, but we'll take a few more. If you don't think you're in control of your thoughts, feel free to doubt. But will you doubt that you're doubting? You're begging the question. Well, suppose you can't doubt that you're doubting. That seems right, but it doesn't fall from that, does it? That you can't doubt that you have a choice whether to think or not. I suppose you have a view. It's just fixed whether, particular times, whether you think or whether you don't is not up to your choice. That seems consistent with saying you can't doubt that you're doubting. So I don't think your argument works. I'm missing something. Now, Alexander, can you help me understand what begging the question is? Well, begging the question means assuming what you're supposed to be proving. So suppose I said something like, well, there can't be innate ideas, because if there could be innate ideas, then we'd be getting some ideas that aren't derived from the senses. And I'd be begging the question, because my reason for denying that there are innate ideas is that I'm saying is inconsistent with saying that we get all ideas from the senses. But just the question that's in dispute is, are there innate ideas, or do we get ideas from the senses? So it's basically begging the question is just assuming what you're supposed to be proving. Now, sometimes it's unfortunate people misuse the phrase now. I've heard people say this on TV, or just mean raising the question, but begging the question does not mean raising the question, it's assuming what you're supposed to be proving. truly. David Kelly says functional complexity has never been a right for spontaneous or not by chance. David Kelly thinks the mind didn't arise spontaneously or not by chance. So it's an interesting point. I mean, then the question would be, would you consider it purely naturalistic causal process to be inconsistent with what you're saying? I think that would be a question you want to ask. Yes, Dylan says begging questions like circular logic. Jerry wants to know about the fallacy of the stolen concept. Well, the fallacy of the stolen concept is, they'll say, you're using a certain concept, but you're disregarding the context in which that concept properly arises. Suppose I say something like, well, I don't think that, I wonder whether the, I'll give you an example where I think they would use it against me. Suppose I say, well, I think maybe we could have concepts that are in an idea. So they would say, why do concepts have to be derived from the senses? Well, they would say, the very notion of a concept properly one that is derived from the senses. So I don't have the right to the concept just by coming up with some weird theory of my own. The way we get the notion of concept is in the way explained in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. So I'm talking about some sort of concept, it's some sort of free-floating notion that I can pack whatever I want into, but in fact, concept arises in a particular way. So I would say, what my opinion of that? Well, I mean, they can say that, and they'd have to make that out in each case. I mean, I don't think they could just say, well, every criticism objectivist commits this fallacy, but it is an interesting idea. Well, I think, unless someone has anything else, I think we're out of time now. So thanks to everybody for coming to my lecture. I hope if you make it to the next one will be much easier than this one, because metaphysical epistemology is a very difficult area. So I hope, thanks very much for staying with me, and I hope you'll all come back next time.